Good afternoon. I'm Dr. Lewis Myers, and this is Healthcare Today. We're going to be talking today about common problems in urology with well-known Vermont urologist Dr. Ernest Bove. May not think of urology as common, but it actually is. These are some of the diagnoses we see most commonly in primary care and in the hospital setting. And if you have experienced any of these or have a question for Dr. Bove today, our phones are open all during the hour at 802-244-1777. So I want to introduce Dr. Ernest Bove, who has been in the Rutland community, serving the Rutland community for many years, and is at Rutland Regional Medical Center. Dr. Bove went to medical school at the University of Vermont. He did his residency in urology at Case Western in Cleveland. He is the past president of the medical staff at Rutland Regional Medical Center, and he is the current president of the New England chapter of the American Urologic Association. I'm honored to have Dr. Bove on the show with us. Good afternoon.
Hi, Lewis. Thank you for having me.
Well, let's talk first about the training that goes into becoming a urologist. People may not be aware of this, but it is one of the longest or longer pathways in medicine. How long did it take to become a urologist?
So it took, I went into a five-year program. I did 2 years of a general surgical internship and residency, and then there was a three-year period of intense urological training at Case Western Reserve in Cleveland, Ohio. There are some residency programs where you go 6 years, 2 years of a general surgical preparation, and then 4 years of urology. One of those years, however, is usually mostly dedicated to urological research. So you're not doing things active clinically, but mostly a research year.
As you went through your general surgery, what was it about urology that led you in that direction?
Well, I actually was very impressed when I was in medical school. Having graduated in 1981, there was a urologist at the UVM Medical Center Hospital of Vermont named Dr. Guy Ledbetter. He was a leader in urology in New England, and it was really the problems that urologists deal with. They're fairly straightforward, and actually, they help people. They're straightforward. We can resolve them relatively quickly. Patients in general are very grateful for your service.
Many of the surgical specialties have traditionally seen a predominance of male surgeons, and I think that may be particularly true in urology. Is that changing?
Oh, very much so. You know, back when I started, first going into urology, 1981, coming into practice, 1986, I'm not sure that we had a female urologist in Vermont, and there was very few throughout the country. But that has now changed. The residency programs have become more populated with women urologists, and they serve an excellent need as we do deal with a lot of women who have urological issues. And it's been a great benefit to have more women in our specialty.
Well, we're going to talk about some of those issues and a number of others. But let's start by talking about something that we see very commonly, and that's kidney stones. I know that's sort of a generic term, but what are kidney stones and what types of stones form, and how do we know when someone has a kidney stone, and then what do we do about it?
Well, most of the time they are associated with acute pain, and it's some of the worst pain that you can get in your back. And if you've ever asked a woman who's had kidney stones and who's had the pain of labor, they would rather have the pain of labor over having a kidney stone. So kidney stones usually develop because there is a precipitation of minerals in the urinary fluid. Most of the stones are calcium-based, and they connect with another element, either oxalate or phosphate. And when this concentration gets high enough, this crystal becomes a stone, sizable enough, and it's actually when the stone has formed and then when it decides to pass to the bladder. Stones by themselves in the kidney that do not cause obstruction to the urinary flow do not tend to cause an issue. The stone, what it does is when it tries to move out of the body, it gets stuck in the tube called the ureter that lies between the kidney and the bladder. And your kidney never stops working. So it's always putting urine in urine, but the problem is that urine can't go anywhere. So what happens is the urine backs up and it creates the kidney to swell. And it's that swelling of the kidney that is responsible for the pain. And sometimes you will often see with the pain blood in the urine. Sometimes kidney stones that don't cause pain that move down the bladder and are close to getting through into the bladder will cause a lot of urinary frequency because they irritate the bladder.
Are there certain people that are prone to get, or certain medical conditions that lead people to be more prone to get kidney stones?
Yes. There's people who have, it's really mostly dietary based. So dietary indiscretion with too much salt in our diet, too much animal protein, and sometimes not enough water. The recommendation is to drink 80 to 100 ounces of a fluid per day. That's not necessarily water, but the preferred juices I recommend the patient in that 80 to 100 are citrus-based juices, because citrus has a way of combining with the calcium molecule, and it doesn't form a crystal. It's more like what we call water-soluble. It doesn't form of precipitation like oxalate and the phosphate that we've talked about. So citrate, we encourage fluids, first of all. We ask people also to limit their sodium intake. We should not have any more sodium than 2,500 milligrams a day. And visually what that is that's about 1 to 2 teaspoons of salt. It's really thought, we used to think it was all calcium that was the problem when I first started 40 years ago, but now there's been good research to show it's the sodium in the diet, and that's why we're tending to see younger people form stones than we used to. The sodium is really, it's hidden sodium. It's in the grains that we eat, all the things that we preserve things, all the foodstuffs that we preserve with sodium, such as bread. We never used to have salt in our bread back in the 60s, but now there's a lot of salt, and that's why a loaf of bread will often last a good, week or 10 days on your shelf. Back in the 60s, it would only last about 48 hours. But it's really the sodium that's in everything, and it's called the hidden salt. So we ask people not to add salt to their cooking, to their food, and to try to watch nutritional labels to try to stay below that 2,500 to 3,000 milligram daily limit that's recommended.
So lowering salt intake, increasing your fluid intake during the day, and perhaps adding some citrus may be helpful, and that calcium is not as lowering calcium in your diet is not as big a factor.
Right. We would recommend that you don't. And the other thing, Lou, is that the other big one is that we eat too much animal protein. It's really the protein that creates like an acidosis in the blood. And when you get acidosis in your bloodstream, that will cause calcium to leach from the bones. And that calcium all has to be filtered through the kidney. So we oftentimes will ask people to limit their animal protein intake to about 6 to 7 ounces a day. Vegetable protein seems to be okay, and the pecking order on animal protein is that fish is a better choice than chicken, and chicken is a better choice than pork, and pork is a better choice than red meat.
Those are helpful to know. So someone comes in often to the emergency department because they're in terrible pain that you described, and you get called. How do you treat someone with kidney stones?
Well, first of all, the most important thing we'd like, because there can be so many causes of abdominal pain, back pain, we tend to order imaging studies, and the preferred imaging study would be a CAT scan of the abdomen and the pelvis. And this is done without the use of contrast material, And we, in terms of the radiation, we do not need to give a lot of radiation with that particular type of CAT scan, because we're not looking for high-resolution things, such as a tumor. We're just looking for a stone. So it's relatively safe. A CAT scan is done. It takes probably less than 30 seconds to go through the machine. And then I will get a report. Somebody will call me. An emergency room physician will say, well, there appears to be a calcification in this location that's causing this patient's pain.
And then what can you do?
So it often depends on the size of the stone. So the size of the stone sort of dictates how we manage. Usually stones under 5 millimeters, and that's about 20% of an inch. There's very small. They have about a 70% chance of spontaneously passing with pain control in fluids. The bigger the stone, however, the more unlikely it is for the stone to pass. And we will tend to have to admit them sometimes if the emergency room physician cannot get the pain under control. I am often called, and we admit the patient to the hospital with IV fluids to help push the stone out and to give them adequate pain control. Sometimes, though, there's small stones that are under 5 millimeters that don't necessarily pass, and that's because the stones they're jagged. They have edges on them. And if all the stones were as smooth as a marble, so to speak, we might have more chance of passing them. But what happens is when we pass a stone from the kidney into the tube automatically contracts like it always does to push the urine forward and tries to push the stone forward. But those jagged edges will sometimes get stuck in the wall of the ureter and cause it to stick there, and therefore they become difficult to pass. But in general, most stones under about 5 millimeters will pass. So it really depends on the level of pain control that we can get for a patient in the emergency room. And if we can't, if the emergency room physician cannot seem to achieve that, then we admit the patient. And sometimes we'll have to intervene to get the stone out.
Tell us about that. What are the methods that you would go after a larger stone or one of these smaller stones that's stuck?
So if the smaller stone is stuck, then the procedure usually is sort of an endoscopic procedure called cystoscopy with ureteroscopy. Cystoscopy means that we're looking into the bladder. Ureteroscopy means we're going to go up that ureter with an even finer scope to look. Sometimes we can simply we actually do an x-ray to precisely locate the stone prior to going up the ureter. I should mention that if stones have passed into the bladder, they will most likely pass. That's because the channel called the urethra that passes from the bladder out is wide enough for a stone to pass. But when stones are stuck in the ureter, we do look up the ureter with a scope. It's called ureteroscopy. This is done under direct vision. And we will often grab the stone with a basket, but if it's too large to be be grabbed with a basket, we will often use laser technology. We often use a holmium laser. We have a fiber that touches the stone, and the energy that's created from that fiber will bust the stone into smaller pieces, and then they are retrieved.
Is there any risk on that? I think it's called lithotripsy or laser. Is there any risk to the patient with that?
That's laser. And yes, if you're not careful, you can sometimes injure the ureter. But you have to be very careful on how to use the fiber, because we don't want to put a hole in the tube called the ureter. Now, there are stones; those are ureteral, but there are often stones that are too big to even pass into the ureter, and they stay in the kidney. And we name the stone based on its location. So we call the stones that are stuck in the kidney, they're renal stones. And these stones are sometimes best treated non-invasively with a procedure called shockwave lithotripsy, which is a non-invasive treatment where the patient comes to the hospital. We do not have to use general anesthesia in those cases. We can use a combination of an IV sedative and an IV narcotic The patient comes. We lay on a special table called a lithotripsy table. And we image the stone usually with ultrasound, and then we shock the stone. There's a what looks to be like a big spark plug that's brought up to the patient's flank, and sound waves are then transmitted from shock waves, I should say, are transmitted from that. From that apparatus, and they come to a point on the stone where all the shocks that have been generated are come to one point, and they break up the stone. That's called shockwave lithotripsy, and that's a non-invasive form of treating a renal stone. And sometimes we can actually use that technology in the ureter as well.
I imagine once these stones are passed or shocked and passed, that it's a huge relief to patients, and then they can proceed with some of the recommendations you've made in terms of hydration and diet. So let me move on to another big topic in urology and big topic in the community, and that is screening and treatment of prostate cancer. Now, this obviously does affect only men, but it's been a real source of controversy about how we screen for prostate cancer. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the most controversial topics over the last few years about which way to go. And one of the federal government's task force had said that it was a very how we screen should be done more diligently. But anyways, so to screen for prostate cancer, usually, just historically, we never had a test to look for prostate issues up until 1992. Prior to that, most of the prostate cancers I saw were men with advanced disease. These people, they had come in, they had difficulty urinating, would often have pain in their back, and that usually meant that the cancer had advanced and spread to their bones. And it was very unfortunate. It was very few people prior to the introduction of a blood test called PSA, which stands for prostate-specific antigen, that we could cure anybody. But along, somebody developed a blood test, and what it did was it measured a product, prostate-specific antigen, which is released by the prostate gland. So we finally had a test that was specific for the prostate, but the problem is that we couldn't specify if the PSA, this blood test, if the problem in the prostate was due to in just prostate enlargement, prostate infection, or prostate cancer. It was helpful, but it wasn't very specific. So that being said, we used to get the powers to be, so to speak, said, well, let's try it for screening. So when people would come in as part of the routine blood work, we would often get a PSA, and if this number was elevated, we would then go to what we call a prostate biopsy to determine whether you might have had prostate cancer. So go forward another 15 years, and the patients that I saw who had advanced disease 15 years later, I rarely saw a patient like that. And that's because the PSA blood test would pick up earlier cancer earlier. But the problem was that some of the people, some of the academic community, they felt, well, you know, maybe the cancer is not as deadly as it could be. So maybe we shouldn't be doing as much screening. There's got to be a better way. And most of these people, we get a lot of prostate cancers, but people rarely die from them.
Let me stop you there for a second. Let's talk about the numbers. People may not think of prostate cancer as being a deadly cancer, but that's not exactly true, is it?
No, because about of the 210,000 newly diagnosed prostate cancers, that are diagnosed every year, the prostate cancer death rate is about somewhere between 25 and 30,000 cases a year. So people start to look at the discrepancy in the number, and they say, well, you know, geez, that's a lot of biopsy and a lot of testing for that kind of death rate, but it's still a real cancer. So that's become a matter of controversy, and we now have some better screening blood tests that are more cancer-specific. In other words, we have a test now called a 4K score, which gives us the risk of developing a high-grade prostate cancer, what your risk is, and it gives me a number between 1 and 100%. Now, within that 4K blood test, they look for more things that people, men with high-grade prostate cancers, are likely to have. They look at these blood clotting proteins, and they're elevated, and these studies have been validated. So we, in this day and age, if we're suspicious enough, we will get a 4K score that'll give me a number. If the number is below a certain number, patients are more involved now, I should say.
Yeah, let me ask you about that. So this fork, so PSA, I would imagine, is still the initial screening test. And then if it's positive, right, who would order the 4K? Would it be a primary care provider, or would it be a urologist, do you think?
Yeah, it probably most likely would be a urologist. We would get a 4K score. Now, there have been the new, a lot of people now are saying, well, we don't need to do a blood test. We can do an MRI of the prostate gland, and it can look for specific lesions or spots in the gland. And maybe that's all we need to do is just send for an MRI and then biopsies those suspicious areas. So I haven't adopted that approach, nor has Blue Cross Blue Shield of Vermont have adopted that approach. I'm a little concerned about screening with MRIs because I know that those x-rays can be wrong, because I've known that usually I use the MRI a lot in the workup of prostate cancer after they've been diagnosed, but I've sent patients who I've known had high-grade prostate cancers and their MRIs don't show anything. So that experience has colored me because I certainly would not want to send a patient for an MRI and have the radiologist say, I don't see anything, and then we miss the cancer. So those things could be missed.
So just to reframe it just for a moment, so part of the controversy is that the concern is that we're finding a lot of prostate cancers, particularly in older men, which may be indolent or slow-growing, and that something else is probably going to lead to that person's, that man's death, and that the prostate cancer, he'll die with prostate cancer, not because of it. The other issue is that the biopsies themselves are painful and sometimes can lead to at least some acute infections, and then that the treatments have a lot of potential side effects for men. So we're going to talk about that after the break, but certainly we can start with that. Tell us about the prostate biopsy, what that entails, and then we'll talk about the treatment.
Okay. What a prostate biopsy, if we make that decision either based on 4K score or an MRI finding, a probe is used to guide us to do these prostate biopsies. So they're not done blindly. And just one of the things before we get to the prostate biopsy, we do pre-treat the patient with antibiotics the day before, the day of, and the day after. And if you've had recent total hip replacements or joint replacements, we add even more of a broader spectrum of antibiotics. Because even with antibiotics, the rate of a bloodborne infection from the procedure, and that term is called septicemia, is still about 5 to 10%. So we give the patient an antibiotic, they come in for the procedure, and a probe is slipped into the rectal area after it's been, you know, we put jelly that has a local anesthetic within it, and a probe is...
Well, we're, in the midst of talking about that, but we're going to come back right after the break, and we're going to hear about more about screening and treatment of prostate cancer and several other urologic issues. Stay with us. We're back for the second half of Healthcare Today, talking with Dr. Ernest Bove, urologist in Rutland. We have been talking about prostate cancer, and Dr. Bove, you were talking about the biopsy. So now you've completed a biopsy, you have some results. How does that help you decide which of your patients needs treatment?
Okay, so it depends on how the volume and how the pathologist tends to score these cancers. So when a pathologist looks under the microscope and determines that the patient has cancer, he looks at the pattern of the cancer. Sometimes these cancer cells look normal, and sometimes these cancer cells are all over the place. So he grades them accordingly. If the patient has a what appears to be normal-looking architecture with not too much out of place, he gives it a lower score called the Gleason score. Gleason was named after a pathologist who designed the system. And if it's a little higher grade, it's associated with it gives it a higher number. The Gleason score is where we start. And it really depends on sometimes the age of the patient. When we decide to I get the patient back into the office, I say, listen, this is a prostate cancer. This is what the Gleason score is. And the recommendation for staging, that is to determine whether the cancer has been extended locally beyond the confines of the prostate in the pelvis, or has it spread. The preferred landing spot for prostate cancer usually is not lung or liver. It's usually in the bones. And so we order what we call staging imaging studies. These are an MRI of the pelvis, which will give us high-resolution images to determine if the prostate cancer has advanced locally, has it involved the local lymph nodes, has it involved the local bony structures. Then we order a bone scan, which is a nuclear medicine type of study, and it looks prostate cancer. Bones will take up the cancer if there's a high, the material that's injected has an affinity towards cancer cells or to any kind of cells that are rapidly dividing. And so we do that, and then we've done more genetic testing in the past 5 years because it's available. And this is very helpful for patients because the questions we would like to ask is that, you know, how aggressive is this tumor? Is this kind of a slow, indolent kind of cancer, or is this a highly aggressive cancer? So my preferred testing method is called a Polaris score. And what the test tells the patient is that if we did nothing with your cancer, what is the likelihood that you would be alive in 10 years? What is the so-called disease-specific mortality? So let's put an example. So if you're a 72-year-old man and your imaging studies, let's assume they're normal, let's say that your disease-specific mortality is only 3%. That means by the time you're 82, there's only a 3% chance of you dying from your cancer. Is it really worth considering radiation treatments or surgery? So that's very helpful. It also helps us, the patient, to know that if they decide that they want to do some definitive treatment, which is either surgery or radiation, it lets them know the likelihood that the cancer might recur over a 10-year period. So I find that is very helpful in trying to help patients make a decision on where they want to go. So let's take that same 72-year-old man again, and let's say he has no advanced disease, no local extension of his disease, and that his 10-year disease-specific mortality is only 3%. He may choose to what we call to perform an active surveillance pathway, which means we're not going to do anything right now, but we're going to continue to monitor your cancer, and we may want to recommend another biopsy of the prostate in a year or so, just to make sure that, you know, nothing's changed, the Gleason score hasn't upgraded, so to speak. And then we would probably re-biopsy if things are unchanged. We would just continue to monitor the patient on active surveillance, and probably from we're not going to biopsy him every year for the next 10 years. But what we might consider, if everything is stable, is just to do follow-up MRIs on the patient, just to make sure that his cancer is in check. Now, if the patient has a higher disease-specific mortality, and he's let's take a 56-year-old guy, and the disease-specific mortality over the next 10 years is 15%. He's got a 15% chance of dying by the time he's 66. Well, you know, that patient might consider choosing an active surveillance pathway, but we would then get into the discussions of does he want to have radiation treatments, or does he want to have his prostate removed in a procedure called radical prostatectomy?
I think one thing that is clear is this is an area of medicine where there has to be a tremendous amount of open discussion between the patient and their doctor, in this case usually a urologist, because there's so many several different pathways you can go. None of them are automatically bad, and even the good ones have side effects. So it is really an important area to have a physician or other provider that you can trust and that can continue to have open discussions.
Right. I think the best thing is that the patients now have more sort of decision-making. They have more information which they're able to make a decision with, okay? There's more information they have. They know what their disease-specific mortality is. They know they've had a high-resolution study. In their age, you know, statistically speaking, when we reach 80, the most likely thing that people die from in their 80s is a cardiovascular event. It's either a stroke or a heart attack. It's not from advanced prostate cancer. So those decisions all come into play, and the patient's age is significant.
Right. I mean, you described prior to 1992 something, you know, like the dark ages. People either would come in and they would almost always have very advanced cancer by the time you saw them. And now you have more information where you can either predict or screen for these things, and it really helps the pathway. I want to, while we have time left, I want to turn to another very common condition that I'm sure you see many men for. And that is erectile dysfunction. And again, prior to the 1990s, we had very little to offer. There are now some medications that came online in the mid to late 1990s. But I wondered if you would talk about diagnosing erectile dysfunction and what are some of the treatment options?
Okay. It all depends on one's definition of erectile dysfunction. The situation is a man comes in and he states that the quality of the erection is no longer satisfactory for him in his wife or partner. So we try to start from there. Now, for some men, the lack of vaginal penetration is problematic. So we take it from the history. The other thing we ask is, are the erections that you do get, are they curved? Do they preclude vaginal penetration? So that's another condition called Peyronie's disease, and I'm sure the audience has seen all the ads for Peyronie's disease on TV. So historically speaking, there are several causes of erectile dysfunction. Aging is one, but people who are diabetic, who develop neuropathies, they can develop neuropathies in the genitalia region, which is the penis. People who have underlying neurological conditions, people who have had spinal cord injuries, people who are on certain medications can have erectile dysfunction. Some people who take anti-anxiety medications can have what we call delayed ejaculatory responses or lack of ejaculation, some medications. But less, so all we had, basically, everybody prior to 1980, everybody thought it was just a psychological issue. But the truth is more the physiology of what is entailed in an erection has come out. We have basically prior in the 80s, the only thing we had to offer a patient for the most part was a what we call a penile implant. That's a device that's placed, that's concealable, it's placed inside the penis, and it comes in a couple varieties. It's either a bendable one, or it's called a malleable, or there is a inflatable penile prosthesis where a man reaches down into a scrotum and pumps. There's a pump down there, and blood fluid flows from a reservoir that's implanted into the patient, into the penile cylinders of the device. However, there was more study, and one of the first things that, historically speaking, we found out that men who were taking certain high blood pressure medications, they were found to have a better erection. And so the whole concept of medical therapy started to come into vogue. And in 1998, Viagra came out, and this was the first drug that was approved for erectile dysfunction. This was produced, I believe, by Pfizer at the time, and then several other drugs came out after that time. And what that drug does was it allowed men to have a better quality erection. I think we're also, and the problem with the drug was they're very expensive, and the companies kind of gouged the patient on the medication. But fortunately, these drugs, there's a few of them out there, Viagra, Cialis, they've come down in price because they've become generic in the last 3 to 4 years. And they were meant, and they've been very helpful for people to use these drugs. There is also normally what these drugs do is the penis is in a low blood flow state, so to speak, but when a man gets aroused, certain chemicals are released by that arousal, which create the blood vessels to dilate, and blood flow comes into the penis. And the way it comes in, the blood is trapped, so therefore you get a firm a penis that's suitable for penetration. But as we get older, sometimes these chemicals are in short supply. We don't produce them well anymore, and so therefore we lack the ability to get an erection. A lot of times these drugs tend to prevent the breakdown of the enzyme that causes for these the dilatation of the blood vessels. So that's drugs. But then we also have what we call injectable agents, which you can inject if you know how to use needles, and you can inject a solution right into the shaft of the penis, which will cause dilatation of these blood vessels. And there's also a gel that we can use with the same medication that goes into the tip of the penis, called Alprostadil. But people, obviously, as you might expect, would be squeamish about putting a needle into your shaft of your penis to get an injection done. The people who do best with those treatments are the people who are insulin-dependent diabetics who are familiar with use of needles. There's another device we use called a vacuum erection device. It's a cylinder that's placed over the shaft of the penis down, and it attaches you put it over the penis, and then you start pumping the cylinder, and it kind of draws the blood into the penis, and then you trap the blood with a ring. That's called a vacuum erection device.
I think one of the things, and so there are a number of different options you can offer, but I think it starts with diagnosis, and and that starts with primary care or sometimes after referral to urologists. It's really important to make sure there aren't any other medical conditions or medications that are interfering with sexual function, and really do a thorough workup before you move on to these. I mean, it's easy just to prescribe the pill, but there may be other conditions that are affecting it that we may not even be aware of at this point.
Yeah, if you can get the diabetes under control early on enough, you can sort of rectify the problem.
Not to mention, obviously, psychological issues or relationship issues at times, which could obviously interfere. But there has been so we're talking about prostate cancer, we're talking about erectile dysfunction, a lot of progress since the 1990s. Certainly an exciting time in that way for urologists because you actually have something to offer people. Let me ask you about people who have recurrent urinary tract infections. And we certainly see that in the hospital. We tend to see it perhaps more with older people coming in. But it's certainly a problem because each one can produce some serious medical problems when people get an infection. What do you do when someone is referred to you who has been referred because they've been having a lot of urinary tract infections?
So we get the definition of kind of used as has the patient had more than three urinary tract infections in a year? And at that point, we begin to get concerned, do they have an underlying structural problem? Are they emptying their bladder completely? Do they have stones? Kidney stones. So, are you emptying your bladder completely? Could be someone who has a neurological condition, who has a weak bladder and can't push the urine out. A male, sometimes older men who have enlarged prostates that do not empty their bladder completely tend to have what we call residual urine. People who have kidney stones can be, they can be a nidus for recurrent urinary tract infections. Certain rare conditions where people have intestinal diseases and that can connect to the bladder, called the fistula, can have recurrent urinary tract infections, people who may have had radiation to the area. So you all take this all in a history, and you find out. So some basic studies are to check let me just backtrack. Sometimes people, you know, it's hard. Sometimes people call their primary care physician and say, you know, I'm burning again. Just call me in a urinary, just call me in an antibiotic. And you can only do that for so long, because what happens is that people begin to get these infections, but there's a resistance that the organism has acquired to the antibiotic, and it makes it very difficult. So the best thing to do if you have a patient is to try to get as good a urine culture as you can, and to analyze it and not necessarily treat it empirically. I understand that those things don't often work out well because it's the weekend or something like that. But to reduce the problems is always to try to get the cleanest catch of urine that you can to helpful, and then to send it and get it cultured, and then treat from there. But these problems we try to rectify their situation. If they have a problem with incomplete bladder emptying, we might want to prescribe something that will help them empty their bladder to reduce that. Sometimes the hardest thing, though, is for people who are elderly and they're in nursing homes, and really this may come as a surprise, but mobility in the elderly patient and their inability to sort of just get up and go to the bathroom, it becomes very a difficult chore, and these patients are susceptible to urinary tract infections. So the nursing home patient, where they just can't be attended to, is very difficult. So there's different situations that present a different challenge of problems for us.
We only have a couple more minutes. I'm going to ask you one quick question. Renal cancer, which is kidney cancer, very serious cancer in many cases. We are now seeing an increased number of them being diagnosed. I think predominantly that's because we're doing CAT scans for other reasons, as we've heard on this show in the past. What's the first thing you do when someone comes in with a recently diagnosed with a renal cancer, at least seen on CT?
So basically for us, it depends. There's been a slight change in the thinking. It depends on the size of the tumor. So if your tumor is less than 4 centimeters, and that for most patients that's about 1.5 inches. In your elderly, we tend to just follow those because they're mostly indolent, and we can follow them with serial CAT scans. And if they get enlarged, then we would do the appropriate treatment. However, if the tumors are larger, then we, depending on the location of the tumor, if the tumor is dead set in the center of the kidney, well, that kidney may have to be removed completely. If it's at one of the poles of the kidney, there's an upper pole and there's a lower pole, and if it's hanging off, what we call an extrafytic type of lesion, you may be able to get by with just removing only part of the kidney and not the whole thing. If the tumor is small enough and is on the edge of the kidney, you can sometimes do radioablation, which is basically you stick a needle into the tumor and you microwave it and burn it out.
I'm going to have to stop now. I had so many other topics listed. We're going to have you back, Dr. Bowe.
Yeah,
I really appreciate you being here. Dr. Ernest Bowe from Rutland Regional Medical Center. I'm going to be away next week. We'll be back in 2 weeks. We're going to be looking at urgent care and occupational health, both in the same hour. I want to thank Steve Cormier, our station manager, for helping me with my show today. See you in 2 weeks. Be kind to each other. Be kind to yourselves.